Okay, so we don't have either a Type 3 review or an appeal today, so I'm going to read the short version. Good afternoon. This is the Design Commission, and I'd like to begin by introducing first the Bureau of Development Services staff who are here today, which includes Tim Herron. And the members of the commission here today are myself, Gwen Milius, Chair, Jane Hansen, and Catherine Schultz, and hopefully Ben Kaiser in a few short minutes. Commission members are private citizens appointed by the mayor to provide review of new construction or remodeling of projects within the designated design zones. We are not paid but serve entirely as volunteers. More detailed information regarding the purpose and function of the commission can be found in the Portland Zoning Code. Commission members must declare a conflict of interest, bias, or ex parte contact prior to staff presentation of a particular case. If a commission member has a conflict of interest or bias, they are not allowed to participate in commission discussion or voting on that project. If a commission member has had an ex parte contact, they must declare the substance of it on the record and it is subject to rebuttal. And that is it.
Excellent. Thank you all for coming today. I know it's a juggle with some schedules, so it's greatly appreciated. Curiously enough, soon after, I went to some effort to gently nudge you all and recrafting your schedules. We may have scared the first item off the docket, which is the one that I really needed a quorum for because I really wanted to put it to bed. Nevertheless, they've postponed their appeal date again, now until August 16th. So we can move on to number two, in which case I'm very happy to introduce Mary Coolidge, Assistant Conservation Director with the Audubon Society, as well as Roberta Jordner with BPS. And they're here to talk about, welcome, Ben. We were doing traffic surveillance, to discuss their resource guide, a draft, a proposal for bird-friendly design, and that's all I have to say, unless you have questions.
For the record, Ben Kaiser just entered the room.
Great. It's on? Yeah, this is on, right? Hi, I'm Roberta Jordner with Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and this is Mary Coolidge, as Tim just said, and we've been working in partnership with other city bureaus and Audubon, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the American Bird Conservancy, and a growing number of local architects and folks in the design community to develop a draft resource guide for bird-friendly building design in Portland. And Mary will describe it in more detail, but we wanted to just give you a little bit of context for where this project comes from and why the city's working on it, as well as talk about the bird strike issue, the solutions that are emerging. And today we were hoping to, field questions from the commission. We know you've seen, at least I've been asked to take a look at the document. We have paper copies here today, if you like them, or CDs, or both. And it's still in the stages of being amended or revised a bit more to reflect comments, and it will be sort of the first edition. It won't be adopted at that point, but it'll be something that people can use for their work. And we'd like to hear your ideas on, after hearing kind of what the discussion's been about so far in Portland, what might be some good next steps to move the issue and the agenda forward. So the city has a history of working on bird issues. In 2003, Mayor Katz signed on with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service into a partnership through the Urban Migratory Bird Conservation Treaty Act. We became a bird treaty city along with seven other cities. The first cities were Chicago and New Orleans. Since then, a number more have joined. I think San Francisco and Washington, D.C. were the latest to join up last year. In doing that, cities enter into an agreement with state and federal agencies and develop sort of a work plan. And our initial work plan, and Portland received a grant to conduct outreach, to do some signage in parks, to develop a CD of information, stories, music about migratory birds. Its focus is a lot on education, also habitat protection, and reducing risks and hazards to birds. Since then, the city has done a number of projects, most recently as part of the BES-led watershed plan, a strategy for working on terrestrial ecology and wildlife species was developed, and the bird agenda was developed as part of that. And those products as well as others were presented to the City Council just a couple of months ago, along with the next 5 years of work. At that point, the bird resource guide was raised at Council. They didn't discuss it, but they are aware that it exists and that there was a recent forum at the Keene headquarters just last week to bring people together to talk about this. So when the city signed on as a treaty city, we brought about 30 partners into the circle from Metro, other jurisdictions, watershed councils, and so forth, and that's been going on for a while. At the same time, there's a national awareness, an international awareness, that the bird collision issue with buildings in cities is growing. A number of cities, including Chicago, New York, Minneapolis, Toronto, and San Francisco, have adopted guidelines of some sort. Some are voluntary, some are mandatory. There are also lights out programs to deal with lighting issues and fatal light attraction to birds. A couple of years ago, Audubon started studying the bird strike issue in Portland, and Mary will talk about what we're finding, but it was enough to know that it is an issue and something we ought to be thinking about and figuring out ways to get out ahead of it. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service awarded the city another small grant last year, and that this guide is one of the products of that effort. It's intended to provide architects, builders, planners with tools they can use in designing their buildings, practical and attractive approaches, and examples from other areas as well as the city of Portland. It has been reviewed by local architects and reflects their comments. And it's also timely in terms of some of the work Planning and Sustainability is doing, in that we're updating our comprehensive plan and the Central City 2035 project and the quadrant plans. And this issue's been raised in public involvement forums already as something that we ought to be looking at. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to Mary to talk more in more depth.
Thanks, Roberta.
Hi, I'm Mary Coolidge with Audubon Society of Portland. Let me just get set up here. So just to give you all a little bit of background, Portland sits along the Pacific Flyway, which is one of the major north-south migration routes in North America that birds use when they're migrating between their wintering and breeding grounds. We have a pretty tremendous diversity of birds here in the city of Portland. 209 bird species regularly occur. If you include unusual occurrences, that number shoots up to about 250. So we have astounding bird diversity here. Not only do birds just have their own inherent value, but they really do a lot of ecological services for us. They disperse seeds, they pollinate plants, they control pest populations, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife released a report in 2009 that reported that this is a multi-million dollar industry in the United States. People are bird watching at an astoundingly growing rate. It's considered one of the fastest growing leisure activities in the U.S. At the same time, researchers are now telling us that up to a billion birds die every year in the U.S. alone as a result of striking a window. That mortality rate is second only to habitat destruction. So it's a huge mortality factor. Here's a glimpse of Portland's historic skyline, pretty architecturally diverse. And like everywhere, I suppose you could say that we are getting taller and we are getting glassier. That's just the trend in development. But we're doing all of this work as well, Roberta touched on this a little bit, to preserve green spaces, to plant trees, to encourage people to install native plants, to install eco-roofs and incentivize that. Are we making sure that we're managing hazards at the same time? A little bit about window strikes. Pardon me. Window strikes can really occur anywhere where there's unmarked glass. So that can be in an urban area, a rural area, a single-story building, a large commercial building, a low-rise commercial building. They happen everywhere where there's unmarked glass. The reason for that is either because there's a reflection that the bird sees that's creating a habitat mirage, or there's transparency to the glass and the bird sees habitat on the other side and thinks that it can access it without hitting an obstacle. One of the other exacerbating factors is that most songbirds actually migrate at night and they're following celestial cues. And not only do artificial city lights dilute those cues that they're using, but they also attract birds for reasons that aren't clearly understood, but birds are attracted into cities. Research also suggests that if you're not looking for evidence of strikes, you won't find them. So they don't tend to make themselves obvious. There are scavengers on the landscape, crows, gulls, dogs, raccoons, that are quick to pick those that evidence up. And they also get lost in vegetation, or they land on eccentric roof lines or people's balconies or awnings. So since we didn't have any really concerted data for what was going on right here in Portland, we started a pilot survey project in the fall of 2009. We were surveying 44 buildings, 4 sky bridges, and the base of the OHSU tram tower. We pretty quickly learned that we were beyond our capacity, since finding volunteers for these early morning surveys is difficult. People would rather be on Mount Tabor counting songbirds that are singing. So we scaled back, and we did 4 more seasons of monitoring at 21 buildings. The upshot of that is that it is a very small sample size. So all we can really say is, here are the numbers of birds striking buildings at 21 of our local buildings downtown, in the downtown area. We'd have to really extrapolate to get a better snapshot of the citywide mortality rate. So we found about 40 to 65 birds per season. We happen to have access to some other pretty interesting data in the form of our Wildlife Care Center up at Audubon on Cornell. People bring birds and wildlife in, and they report why they're bringing that animal in. So 200 to 300 intakes per year, or calls about birds striking a window. That's in addition to the 40 to 65 birds that we're picking up on our surveys. Our downtown surveys, which we call BirdSafe Portland surveys, picked up 36 species of warblers, flycatchers, hummingbirds, woodpeckers, some pretty cool species. And if you look at the same time period, our Wildlife Care Center was tracking 83 species of native birds during that time. Oh, you can't see any color on this slide on the screen, but this is the Audubon Common Birds in Decline report from 2007. In the left-hand column, the barn swallow is one of the birds that we found on our surveys, golden crown kinglet, fox sparrow, and evening grosbeak. In the right-hand column, American goldfinch, mourning dove, willow flycatcher, rufous hummingbird, Pacific slope flycatcher, orange-crowned warbler, and white-crowned sparrow. Now, whether or not you're familiar with any of these bird species, the idea is we're not necessarily picking up crows and jays. In fact, they're very unusual strike victims. We're picking up this much more diverse list of birds that have hit windows. One thing that's coming out of the research that's being done is the determination that the percentage of unmarked glass on a facade is actually the strongest predictor of the bird mortality that will occur at that building. That number goes up even if there's vegetation reflected in the windows. There are some very common design traps in the San Francisco bird-friendly building guidelines document. They call these feature-related hazards. Unmarked glass walls, the kind of thing that you see there in the lower left photo at the Merriweather, those balcony railings, there's glass in those, and birds don't see it. Nearby banks of glass, like in the top picture, it's a little bit dark, but that's the Good Sam Sky Bridge, and you can see vegetation through both of those adjacent panes of glass, and birds don't necessarily see that as an obstacle. And then even reflective glass can... even transparent glass can, in certain conditions of light, produce a reflection. So in that lower left-hand corner, sometimes there is a reflection in that window. Other times you can look right through that glass, through the glass around the corner, and see the Ross Island Bridge. So there can be transparency and reflectivity in the same bank of glass. Reflections can also produce a look of urban canyons. So birds may be trying to fly to habitat, but they may also just be trying to fly past the building that they see reflected in the window in front of them. Such was the case with this orange-crowned warbler here on the lower left photo. Another reflective pane of glass, and you can also see that there's a reflection there in the marble on that facade at the BPA building in Lloyd. This is a photo taken at Lewis and Clark Law School. The LRC building was designed to disappear into the adjacent Tryon Creek State Park. It does it very effectively, and it was the site of many bird collisions. Students there were tracking those collisions. We joined in to help with that. Here's another photo taken when the trees are leafed out. You can see why a bird might mistake that for habitat. And they did this very cool retrofit project up there where they put exterior screens on all of the windows. That was after a couple of years of doing various test materials on those windows, and they went with this solution. It's been quite successful as far as we know. We haven't found any birds or had any birds reported to us since those screens went in. Both, actually, and the solution was designed to do both. So it was to insulate the impact if they did still try to fly into it, because you can see that there is still some reflection of habitat, but also to mute the reflection to try to reduce the birds even flying into the window in the first place. So this is just sort of a little comic relief. We're not asking for architects and building designers to build. Do you like that? Would you guys approve that downtown? In fact, what we've seen happening is this trend to develop bird-friendly building guidelines or some version thereof in various cities and jurisdictions across the country. New York City was the first to do this in 2007. They have voluntary guidelines. Roberta mentioned that there's a combination of voluntary and mandatory guidelines across the country. American Bird Conservancy just last year produced a universalized template. What we did was revise that document for use in the city of Portland, and we pulled together a team of architects and designers to review that ABC template and give us input on what it would take to make this document tenable in Portland. And this is the result of that draft, May 2012. The very basic concepts of bird-friendly building design is to, first of all, consider the location and surroundings. So in the case of the Lewis and Clark Law School, it's adjacent to forested Tryon Creek State Park. That's a site that would be a great candidate for doing something to alleviate potential bird collisions. Just to take you on a little side note for a moment, another site consideration might be the Willamette Park Pump Station that's recently been considered by this committee, a site in a park adjacent to the Willamette River where birds are definitely moving through on migration and possibly using habitat during nesting season, probably a good candidate site to do something to try to reduce reflectivity or transparency. So the basic concepts are to treat glass. There's something called the 2x4 rule, which is more appropriately the 2x4 rule, which says that a bird will try to fly through an unmarked space that is as small as 2 inches high or 4 inches wide. It's also called the handprint rule. So if you hold your hand out horizontally, the idea is basically that a bird could potentially fit through a space this small and will potentially try to fly through it. Now, that sounds like you'd have to create visual markers very densely across the window, but in fact, I will talk about what some of the research is showing about how much patterning has to be on a window. But essentially, the idea is to interrupt reflections, particularly in the first 40 feet above grade and adjacent to eco roofs. Those are considered high hazard zones. And then to treat transparency at corners and sky bridges. There's a photo there on the right of a corner at the Wildlife Conservation Society building in the Bronx Zoo, where they used a UV patterned glass that is difficult for people to see, but visible to birds and helps reduce transparency. The other ideas are to minimize light spill from the interior, to shield all exterior fixtures, meaning full cutoff above 90 degrees, and to eliminate unnecessary lighting from midnight to 6 a.m. I do just want to mention that there is a new LEED pilot credit, Bird Collision Deterrence, Pilot Credit 55, that essentially takes all of these bird-friendly building design concepts and weaves it into a pilot credit that designers can try to achieve when they're putting up a new building. The basic ways to interrupt reflections in glass are to use something like a UV-patterned glass that we saw in that last slide, to use opaque, etched, fritted, translucent, screen-printed, or frosted glass to reduce reflections, or to do something to the exterior of the building, like facades, netting, shutters, louvers, that kind of thing. The lower right-hand picture there is the San Francisco Federal Building, where they used a metal framework on the outside of the building. So research on marked glass is being done by three main researchers in the United States and in Germany, Clem, Rossler, and Shepard. They're using tunnel testing, where they provide a bird with two options and a flight path. One of the options is clear glass. The other option is some kind of material that is designed to reduce bird collisions. There's an example there on the right of a narrow horizontal stripe pattern. Effective patterns, which means that they reduce strikes by 90% minimum, can cover as little as 5% of the glass. So you can really get it down to a pretty minimal design on the window and still achieve a deterrence. One of the things that we really tried to capitalize in our rewriting of the bird-friendly building design resource guide was maximization of synergies, so looking at other design objectives that an architect might be trying to achieve and how those might fit really nicely hand-in-hand with a way to make the building bird-friendly. There on the left is the new Federal Building, the Edith Green Wendell Wyatt Federal Building, where they've put metal fins on the west facade of the building, and there's framework on two other sides of the building. Now, they did that to reduce solar heat gain. They didn't do it for bird friendliness, but it will presumably help to reduce bird collisions at that building. The upper right-hand photo is taken at the OHSU Center for Health and Healing, where they used fretwork on much of the windows there to reduce solar heat gain and also to create some kind of enveloping for the internal user of the building. It also happens that in five seasons of monitoring bird strikes, we have never found a bird at this building, whereas we've found birds at every other windowed building in South Waterfront. So could this be a bird-friendly building design approach? Quite possibly. Other synergies are potentially branding. So there on the left, that's the John Ross lower level. That design has since come down, but at one time they had pictures of kingfishers and kites and bikes and flowers and sort of an appealing snapshot of what life could be like in South Waterfront. So they did that for branding and probably to create some interest there. In the right-hand picture, that's the Atwater Sales Suite. That's their motif that they use to brand throughout their building, and they also did it on their sales suite door. Now, if that fretwork were on the outside of the building, it would do a better job of reducing reflections. So that is one of the approaches, is to move fretwork to the outside. Here's another example of branding and creating some interest to pedestrians passing on the street. This is the Whole Foods Market on Northeast Sandy at about 44th. Where they used a bike mechanism motif, and they fritted the inside of those windows. So again, we would say frit the outside of the window, and then you have a bird-friendly building design. This is the pool room window at the Mirabella in South Waterfront, where they had window film attached to that window after the building went up to create privacy for folks using the athletic center and the pool. They also carried through a design aesthetic that is prevalent throughout the rest of the building, this grassy motif. So they branded that window, they carried the motif, and they achieved privacy. And then research has also demonstrated that creating artwork on glass, something like this bus stop glasswork, helps to reduce vandalism. It also marks those freestanding glass walls for birds. On the right is the Aqua Tower, designed by Studio Gang Architects in Chicago, and they created this undulating effect to help mark the otherwise glassy expanse for birds. This is a photo taken at the Wildlife Conservation Society building, where they used sunshades adjacent to an eco roof to help reduce bird collisions. And this is a concept design. It's not yet built. Studio Gang did this again in Chicago, where they used the history of the site, which had some kind of industrial steel use, and they interwove this rebar design to help reduce birds flying into those windows that are off to the right there. It's not yet built, but potentially a bird-friendly design. This is the New York Times headquarters building designed by Renzo Piano and FX Fowl Architects. They put a ceramic tubing framework around the outside of that building primarily to reduce solar heat gain and to create an architectural interest for the building. It also happens to make it very bird-friendly because it marks those windows for birds. So getting back to the idea of lighting design, the suggestion is to optimize useful light and to minimize light spill, which again means full cutoff shields above 90 degrees, eliminating vanity lighting and uplighting. So as we see in the upper right-hand corner, the OHSU tram tower has several floodlights at the base of it. There are also lights affixed to the top of that tower, which are effectively reducing the light spill there coming up from the ground. Eliminating spotlights and searchlights during migration seasons and using auto controls because it's difficult to rely on people to turn lights off when they leave a room, so installing motion detectors. Here's an example of lighting that could be improved by reducing or by installing shields on top of those lights. That light is essentially spilling in all directions. There are lots of resources. I hope that you all have had a chance to see the resource guide that we produced. If not, we have copies here. We also have CDs. And thanks for your time today.
Thank you for the presentation. Are there questions for presenters?
Just a quick question, kind of more science question. Like, if you do window film screenage, for instance, in the store, if you do it on the inside, is that signage? Like, if you said Frank's ice cream shop, you did a film and big glass on the inside.
Yeah, some screening techniques would technically be considered signage, depending on how they were applied. So we have some exemptions for sign area, so that would fall neatly into that. We also have exceptions for sign area if it is carved into a building material, so something of etched glass would be exempt from the sign code. But you're absolutely correct. If it was a film or a landscape that was designed in a kind of bird-friendly building sign guideline way, we may have to consider it sign area, and then that would have some other ripple effects. The point being to that is we don't regulate content. So it's a bunch of reedy glass or reeds or plants or flowers. We, meaning the city, cannot enforce it to stay that way when it changes into a stack of Coors light cans outside the deli. So there's some, when you apply a material to glass, it kind of triggers the sign code in a content neutral way. So, but I think, I mean, we haven't had that come up, and it's a technicality, and I think the etched glass is probably the more permanent and also exemptable way to get it done and make sure it stays that way.
Right, as opposed to a plastic film applied, which right. On the outside, I mean, people have a tendency to pick at it, and it.
Yep.
It's so much more expensive. I mean.
Yep. Yeah, and that could be something we consider or work about when projects like this.
And hard to retrofit, whereas you can mm-hmm. retrofit with something that's film applied.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I had kind of a question about the numbers. Just given how many strikes go undetected, do you know how the National Audubon Society arrived at a billion, or whoever it was that had the billion number in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's actually not a National Audubon Society figure. It comes from some of the leading researchers who are working on this in the United States. Daniel Clem is one of those out of Pennsylvania, and he took figures. He's been researching this for, I think, 30-some years now, and mm-hmm. he took his figures from buildings that he had been monitoring. He also collects strike data from many, many jurisdictions. And he multiplied that by, I believe, 2007 census data about the number of buildings in the United States.
Okay.
And that formula gave him the number of 1 billion.
So just what are your hopes out of this report, and what would be ideal? what would be the ideal outcome?
Well, you know, it remains to be seen. Roberta was mentioning we had a forum to kick this off just last week, last Thursday night. We had about 100 people show up. We've gotten some very good feedback from architects who've participated in the process, as well as architects who are just learning about this. Folks tend to be interested. Architects are fairly receptive to the idea that here's one more challenge. What can we potentially do? And they're being asked to be creative. So our hope is that in releasing this voluntary set of guidelines, that we will get folks actually applying some of these principles to upcoming designs. I don't know what the figures are in other cities where they've done just voluntary guidelines so far, as opposed to making it regulatory, like in San Francisco in some cases and in Toronto in all cases. But our hope is, from the Design Commission, I think at this point, that at least this gets applied discretionarily, maybe in cases like the Willamette Park pump station design. It might be an opportunity to say, what would this look like if we ran this through a bird-friendly building design filter? And testing these out for applicability and usability and cost effectiveness. Do you want to add anything to that, Roberta?
Well, I think, you know, we're really interested in the synergy issue, you know, the growing body of research on ways to reduce energy demand and reduce carbon footprint. And to the extent we can sync these things up, it's an issue people resonate with generally.
Right.
And, you know, it's been sort of heartening to hear from some of the local architects that they're interested. They've been having presentations in their offices. There was an AIA continuing education class the morning after the design forum, and the feedback that we got was, you know, really good questions about data, what works. People want to invest in, if they're going to invest in things, they want to know that it works. They are interested in practical solutions. There's an interest in seeing the manufacturing. Manufacturers begin to explore the options, and the LEED credit might help sort of trigger some of that work. There's been very preliminary discussions about reaching out to some of the property owners and developers that are involved in the eco-district concept, and as they're looking at some of the development projects that are going to go forward, and they're doing their modeling for energy and all that stuff, could we pilot sort of a modeling effort to see what the cost effectiveness or feasibility, and dovetail that with the energy and other objectives for the eco-district, and see where we can get those common grounds and that complementary stuff. So we're sort of exploring. It feels good to have it be sort of coming from the ground up and have folks take it on. That's kind of curious about what your reaction is to.
It's certainly easier to have people come here prepared to talk about it than have it come from this body outward. I mean, I think that I'd rather have design teams know about it first and developers. And I think certainly the owners that come here to this commission are all in various degrees of experiencing various degrees of enlightenment about even other green issues and sustainability and some of the other kind of what we call humane issues that we bring up that might be news to them that are sort of implied in some of our design guidelines but aren't necessarily explicitly stated. And of course, we get varying degrees of frustration fed back to us about stuff coming in late and ideas that they've never heard of being applied to projects, you know. So I think, I mean, if I were, from my standpoint, my own selfish perspective, it's nice to hear that you're out training the architecture community and that you're also approaching building owners, because I think that I think good architects can be great advocates for these kinds of issues with their building owners. But I mean, the synergies thing is a great thing to coattail on. If you can say, like, look, this not only, you know, reduces your energy load, but it's also bird friendly, as it, you know, happens to be something that you're already doing or something that you might already do that we can just twist a little bit and it won't cost you anything more. I think that's all to the good. But when it comes from us as sort of this new, you know, well, last year's favorite flavor was, well, did you think about what you're going to do for all the bicyclists? And then, you know, and then it'll be like, well, what about the birds? And, you know, and people kind of, at some point, they're just like, oh, brother, you know, next thing you know, you're going to be asking me about, I don't know, you know. So it's helpful when you're out there helping us by filling people in.
That's good to
know. Yeah.
Yeah, I would just comment that we've been doing a lot of outreach to really try to get awareness raised about this, and we do have a few champions in the architecture community, which I think could help facilitate this along. We had Bruce Fowle come out last week for our bird-friendly building design forum. He's a pretty well-known architect in New York City. He works internationally, and I think that it helps to create some normative momentum there, you know, when architects see their other peers that are working on this kind of concept. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that is very helpful.
I was curious. I was a little surprised when you were saying it's the first 40 feet that tends to get more stripes.
Yeah, I was surprised by that, too.
And do you know why or what it is about that area of their habitat that makes it?
Yeah,
I
think,
would have thought they were flying higher. I guess
it
surprised me.
I think it's primarily because that's the area where they're foraging and spending most of their time. We have received reports of birds hitting windows up to, I think, the 23rd floor, where we get reports from people who have balconies, and birds end up on those balconies. So it's not to say that birds only strike within the first 40 feet of a building, but they're spending the bulk of their time foraging in that area, nesting in that area. And so that's where they're most likely to see vegetation reflected in the windows and most likely to encounter glass.
And then,
makes sense.
And then Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of the migrating bird situation and migrating at night, at that point, lighting becomes maybe more of an issue than the reflectivity and transparency because it's nighttime. And you'll get these larger flocks coming through along like the Mississippi Flyway and places like that. I don't know that we've seen these, you know, massive 100 or 1,000 bird hits, but the birds are attracted to light and they get more disoriented when it's raining and foggy, which we have a fair bit of. And at that point, the migrating birds could be hitting at the higher levels, right?
Yeah, the issue is that inclement weather brings them to a lower migration altitude, and they're more likely to come into contact with tall buildings and cities. The research has shown that it takes it generally is the biggest issue with buildings that exceed 350 or 400 feet. We haven't seen a catastrophic collision issue here in Portland. Doesn't mean that we couldn't have one at some point if we started building taller buildings. But at this point, I think our issue locally from what limited research we have to reflect upon is a daytime strike issue. So lower floors, daytime transparency, reflectivity.
So in the cities that do have regulations, what are those regulations saying? How are they regulating this issue?
Most recently, San Francisco has adopted a standard for bird-safe buildings, and theirs is a two-part document, partially regulatory, partially voluntary. Regulatory bird-friendly building design compliance is triggered for buildings that are within 300 feet of an uninterrupted sight line to either open water, wetlands, or natural area. So, park open space, but not something like a ball field. So in the case that a building is going up essentially adjacent to open water, wetlands, or open space, that triggers the requirement that they do bird-friendly building design. Other than that, when a facade is greater than 50% glass, they also trigger that. So that's the feature-related hazard trigger.
And then that bird-friendly design, they have to abide by that at that point? There's some other body that says that is, in fact, passing the bird-friendly design?
Correct. They have a set of approaches. It is possible to get approval on a design by going by implementing a different design approach, but then you have to have an independent biologist or somebody else approve your design approach to basically say, yes, this too meets the bird-friendly building design requirement.
Would you favor regulating this issue in Portland, or would you keep it voluntary?
You know, given that we have only just released this document, I think we owe it to architects and designers and builders locally to give them an opportunity to use the voluntary guidelines. I think at some point, if there's no compliance, it may be advisable to go regulatory. But I think at this point, we wait to see what happens with the voluntary document and whether we get use.
And on that, I think your point is kind of important. It's just coming onto the radar. And, you know, the first order of business is to have people understand the issue and its causes. And that way, I mean, it wouldn't be possible, I don't think, to talk about regulations about an issue people don't know about. They really need to understand. And to the extent people can own the issue and if it becomes something that... you know, we can provide incentives. I think the first, you know, other things to explore might be incentives, whether they're regulatory incentives or financial incentives, or, you know, there may be ways to join this up with some of our energy efficiency related programs. Another possible first option would be to look at what can we do with city buildings first, to sort of set an example. So those are kind of things that we're sort of thinking about. What's your thought about that?
Oh, yeah, well, I probably... not in favor of regulations. It would be interesting to get it as part of the lead list or something. Mm-hmm. You get a credit or, like you said, incentivize rather than penalize. So I could just see the expense, as you can imagine, the expense of adding screens, idea, green. I mean, it goes up a lot. But again, I don't know. Especially if you're doing that 2x4, it's pretty tricky, but I don't know the whole picture yet.
Yeah, and that's why we're capitalizing on synergies. So the Edith Green building certainly wasn't designed with all of that framework for any kind of bird-friendly reason. So essentially the bird-friendly factor in that building, if it turns out to be bird-friendly, will be free.
Yeah. Right.
And there is a lead pilot credit at this point. Yeah, pilot credit 55, bird collision deterrence. So it's being tested. They just rolled it out late last year. It may or may not get written into the next version of LEED, depending on how well it goes. There are a number of buildings that have applied for the credit, so it's being tested.
Yeah, it just seems like you don't want to become regulatory too fast, because I think that limits people's ability to approach the design creatively. And a lot of the examples that you showed were sort of cage-like. At least they seemed cage-like to me for the humans in the building. And so it just seems like, I think something needs to evolve with approaches to glass or how glass is being treated. Or, I mean, I think there's a lot of other solutions out there that just haven't been thought of yet. But I think the goal is commendable.
Yeah, and I think we have a lot of attention right now from glass manufacturers. We had some at our forum this past week, and I know that in other cities, glass manufacturers are really paying attention. So hopefully that will help drive more research and development on their products and ultimately affordability.
Okay. Would you? Would any of you like to have a copy of the
sure.
report and or the CD?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be great. I have the PDF, but it'd be nice to have something I can hand around. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious to know how it goes out there. And the other thing that might be interesting for you guys to contemplate is if there are areas of the city that are undergoing planning exercises where they're doing, you know, local design guidelines for certain areas, and if they happen to be close to, you know, a waterway or the river or whatever, and that they're in the process of contemplating design guidelines for their area, it would be a good time to talk to them about also integrating bird-friendly design into their community design standards. So, you know, I know we're going through a bunch of planning like that right now in the central city, so it might be a good time to talk to those steering committees about it.
Yeah, we're prioritizing having that discussion with the Lloyd Eco District folks. So,
yeah,
good point.
Okay. Great.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. You want me to leave some of these with you for the other members?
Yeah. Could you do that? That would be great, Roberta.
Well, you know, we could take a break or we could just keep going. And if we're ready. Are we ready? Sorry, what was that? To keep going?
Yeah.